Welcome to the How the Why. With John Barrett Ingalls. Exploring and celebrating the creative process and the creative purpose of authors, editors, and artists that make up and inspire the Black Hill Press family. Black Hill Press is dedicated to the novella. We believe a great story is never defined by its length. Let's get creative.
Hello, and welcome to the How, the Why, brought to you by Black Hill Press. My name is John Barrett Ingalls, and today we are connected with Ken Bauman, the publisher and editor and all-around god of Sator Press, or Sator Press, or Sator, or however you want to pronounce it. Press. I already messed it up.
That's Ken, good.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, I was looking at your the Sator square, and I started doing research and found that the Satorotas square is this charm that was discovered, you know, thousands of years ago or hundreds of years ago, thousands, I'm thinking, to ward off evil. How did you come up with using this as your press name and just discovering the Satorotas square?
That's a good question. Well, I mean, primarily, I'd like to think that the Sator square for me helps draw in evil as opposed to ward it off. But I first found it, I don't know, probably just like weird late night Googling, looking for weird glyphs and images. And then, I mean, I just sort of became fascinated with it in a pretty benign way. And then later, when the idea of running a press presented itself, I went, you know what, that would look pretty good on the spine of a book. You know, I'm a writer and a reader and a publisher who's very interested in literature on a language level and not primarily or even just on a sort of narrative or plot level. And so this weird glyph that was you know, palindromic and in a bunch of different directions seemed interesting to me. And I also like the sort of idea of the Sator square being one of the earliest memes in recorded history, and insofar as nobody can really understand or place this early graffiti within any sort of ideology. Some people think it might have been Christian graffiti, but nobody really knows for sure. It's just sort of like a weird errant question mark in history that still, I feel like, as a symbol, has a kind of unique power and stays with people.
You know, we're talking about this thing that most of our listeners are like, oh, what a glyph mean? But what it is the word Sator, S-A-T-O-R, written up and down and backwards. And then in the middle, off of the T, is the word tenet. And then off of the A is arepo. And then opera off of the – and then it's just – it's kind of like a crossword puzzle – not a crossword, like a word search, but with that. And so, you know, I'm staring at it right now on the screen, and all I see is the word tenet, which is idea, which is, you know, the origin of thought, which I think is pretty awesome too, that's, you know, you're just staring at this word, and then the word opera is right underneath it. I wish I had a visual for my listeners. So go and look up Satorotas square, and you'll see what we're talking about. Yeah, it's very cool. Very cool. Yeah, the opera keeps popping up too, and then which is really appropriate for what you're doing with the press.
Yeah, I would like to think that I've got published books that are powerfully vocal, whether or not that means in terms of volume or not. I still like to think that the books have a pretty strong voice.
Yeah, you wrote on your page you want to promote challenging literature with Sator. Oh, man, see, Sator. I'm going to use your. You want to promote challenging literature with Sator. What do you consider? What does that mean? That's a pretty broad term.
It is. You know, I find that I probably can't give a decent answer to that question beyond how I'd answer it just as an individual reader. You know, I've always been drawn to books that kind of make me teeter on that line of like wanting to rip the book apart and wanting to never stop reading it. Just sort of that obsessive, any book that can draw out in me my obsessive tendencies, my sort of conspiracy theorist tendencies, my tendencies to really like want to disappear into an entire branch of literature or into a school of thought or into just an author's career or their work. Those are the kind of books that really, I don't know, feel worthwhile to me. The kind of books that feel like they present questions that are just maddeningly unanswerable, but more importantly, do so in a way that is really beautiful and alluring. You know, I don't just want like a dumb riddle. I want a really sort of magnificent riddle, something that like, you know, it just will keep me coming back to it. And I feel like those books oftentimes also contain messages that are either politically or socially sort of what I feel to be urgent. And like, for example, with Confessions from a Dark Wood, the novel I published by a guy named Eric Raymond, that book to me does a lot of things that I feel like exemplify what I'm going for in the press. It is incredibly sharp-witted and accurate satire. I feel like via satire, it captures, it takes rather sort of a portrait of the contemporary world that is fucking hilarious, but also incredibly bleak, and really good at sort of casting light on really deep, disgusting faults. And not to say that it's just like moralist and preachy, because it's not. I mean, like all good satire, it's primarily just hilarious and clever and smart and emotional and involving. And yet at the same time, I mean, just on like a sentence or paragraph level, I really think that Eric is, I mean, he's, I feel like taking up the baton that DeLillo began running with, and I think he's going in an interesting new direction. And so it's just, it's like books like that, you know, that sort of hit on multiple levels and yet contain mysteries or contain questions that, like I said, we can't necessarily answer, but those are the questions that always kind of, you know, make us kind of tear our hair out or just like press the book into other people's hands and say, like, you have to fucking read this. This is, you know, this is inexplicably good.
What were some of the inspirations? Like, give us a little taste outside of what you publish, of what inspired you to publish what you do publish. Wow, that Absolutely. Was a weird sentence.
No. It made total sense. Well, I, you know, it's strange because at the time that I started the press, let's see, what was I reading? I was reading a lot of work by guys like Blake Butler, and he's, you know, I blame him for Sator Press because he kind of led me to start it obliquely. I'll talk about that in a second. But guys like Blake Butler and Tao Lin, I was reading a lot of Beckett. I was reading Bolaño, I was reading Clarice Lispector, and you know, I was really engaged in like the small indie press world, and particularly the indie presses and writers who were publishing stuff online, and I didn't necessarily see like a smaller indie press that sort of was putting out books in the aesthetic that I felt like I was most attracted to. I saw some presses were doing it to a certain extent, but I thought, huh, okay, well, maybe, you know, if this is something I wanted to do, maybe I could do it. But I just sort of put it aside. I was publishing a literary journal with that guy, Blake Butler, and it was called No Colony. We were doing that for a few years. And I had told him I was toying around with the idea of, like, starting a press and publishing full-length titles. And then he emailed me the manuscript to the complete works of Marvin K. Mooney, and by Christopher Higgs, and that book really kind of blew my mind, and I realized that, like, oh shit, I have to do this press now because this book is so good. Mm. And so within like 12 hours, I had come up with a business plan. I mean, it wasn't really a business plan, but it was like maybe slightly convincing as a business plan. And then, you know, went like, okay, I can get a little money from here. And I emailed Chris and I was like, I'll pay you this. We'll do this. I have to publish your book. And then suddenly I kind of had, like, Chris's book had convinced me that I needed to start this press.
So you've been around since 2009, and it's not like you're pumping out, you know, five books a year or even two books a year. Yep. You're very, seems particular or you're finding the perfect book to be released through Sator. What is your vetting process, or do you take submissions, do you accept submissions, or are you seeking these works out?
I do accept submissions. It's strange because I'm kind of for each book I've published, it's kind of strange. So I got past Mooney by a friend. And I didn't really know Chris Higgs's writing. I mean, I'd read it a little bit here and there online, but I didn't know him until I decided to publish his book. And then with the next book I published, The Angel and the Dream of Our Hangover by Mark Leidner, that one I solicited. I had been a fan of Mark's poetry for a long time. I'd been following him on Twitter, and on Twitter, I just sent him a message saying, like, hey, you're on fire with these sort of aphorisms lately. I want to collect them and publish them as a book. And then over the course of like the next year and a half, we worked on drafts of like a collection of aphorisms and poems and collages. And so that one just took a while. That was just us kind of like building the book back and forth. And then Confessions was strange. This is kind of my favorite story. So I like Blake Butler on Twitter. This is so funny. Like, I got to thank Twitter for being a medium by which I find a lot of these people. He retweeted a joke, like a Beckett joke. and I was like, well, that's pretty fucking funny. So I clicked through to the guy who wrote this Beckett joke. And then, you know, he had like the little website tag on his Twitter profile. And I clicked through to that, and it was just like a single page, really simple, with blurbs for a book that didn't yet exist. And the blurbs were, I mean, I knew that the blurbs were fake, but I had a hunch that the book was not fake. And so I emailed Eric and I said, you know, this is interesting. Like, what is this for? You know, what are these fake blurbs for? I want to read it. And he didn't email me for, I think, like maybe six to 8 months. And then when he finally did, I again read the manuscript and freaked out over it. And then this last book, No Other by Mark Gluth, I had read his first book, The Late Works of Margaret Croftus, and I really loved it. And then so when I saw that, you know, he'd been – and I knew he had been working on this novel, his second novel, for about 5 years through mutual friends. And so when he just – when that landed in my inbox, I went, oh, holy shit, I got to read this. But so that's like – most of the people that I began to publish I've sort of known of or have read their work in the past. I've got two more books. I don't know which one's going to come through. If either come through, they're both kind of question marks. But then after that, I'm just going to publish only submissions. I'm not going to solicit. I'm only going to publish stuff by people who don't identify as male. And
now, where did that? What inspired that? parameter for your submissions?
I guess because I've just published a lot of fucking white dudes, which is fine. I mean, I don't have a problem with you know, really good books being written by white dudes at all. I just realized I kind of was thinking like, oh, okay, well, Mark and Chris and Eric and the other Mark, like, lovely guys, all really wonderful people, but all white and all dudes. So maybe just for like for the sake of my press and just for the sake of like giving people who might not have an easier time getting published, giving them the opportunity to get published, and then just finding more interesting stuff, because I'm probably publishing stuff that has some sort of thread of like a preference for a kind of literature that white dudes write. Probably. I mean, I'm a white dude, so I can't, if I can try to consciously get away from that, but, and also not, not let the press, publish stuff that I don't find as interesting, I'd like to do that. I'd like to publish great stuff just from more diverse voices if I can.
So within that parameter, if you ended up with, some work that spoke to you from another white dude, would you be open to it? Or
It's interesting. I put that on the site and stuff, and then wrote about it on Facebook, you know, just said something like, oh, okay, in the future Sator's only going to do this, I've had some like friends and friends of friends who all happen to be white dudes send emails, and I think it was like the, oh shit, like if I'm interested in Sator, I better get my manuscript in now. And I'll certainly read them. I'll definitely read them. I mean, I'm like a one guy running this press. I don't have any, there are no like corporate check marks and checklists I have to hit. I just kind of can do what I want. So,
of course. I mean, yeah, it is. Everything is you.
Yeah, exactly. For better or worse, probably ultimately for worse. But that means that, yeah, if I read a great book, I'll put it out. You know, it's not no hard lines here. I just have like kind of a desire to like I said, get some work out there in the world from more diverse voices.
Sure. Now let's talk a little bit about you as a writer. How did that get started? I know you have three books out. Two novels and your nonfiction Earthbound. Mm-hmm. How did you, at what point in your life did you say, oh, I'm a storyteller and I have to tell these stories?
That's a good question. I just think it's that, I mean, it's kind of that like silly cliche thing that, I feel like a lot of artists say like, oh, well, I just, you know, we're all artists when we're kids and I just didn't stop. It was kind of the same thing with writing for me. Like, I always enjoyed writing. I mean, when I was five, I was making my parents read these, you know, abysmal little stories that, of course, didn't go anywhere, but always didn't seem to involve, like, chainsaws or motorcycles or dragons or something. And then I just, you know, began to actually read interesting stuff or like, you know, whatever, capital L literature, when I got old enough to understand what the hell was going on the page, or think I understood what was going on the page. And then I went, oh, like, wow, this is a big world. It's not just a world in which you can kind of encounter fantastical ideas and worlds, you know, like I read a lot of fantasy when I was a kid. I went, oh, this is actually, there's a world that's beyond the world of just like mythos and exotic locales. Like, there's a world of ideas that are equally as exotic and ultimately much more weird. And so I just thought, well, okay, yeah, that makes total sense. I'll keep reading that and keep writing that. And so I've always, I mean, pretty much since I was a kid, I've taken writing and reading really seriously, or as seriously as I can take, you know, something that I just kind of do all the time. I want to say that I just kind of didn't stop. And I kept being fed by the books I was reading in a way that I didn't really feel like I was getting fed by other kind of media I was consuming. And then that's it. And then some, you know, some crazy people gave me the opportunity to get my books published, which I'm sure they should, if they don't already, regret.
Do you consider your work challenging? Is like the work that you write the same kind of in the same vein of what you want to be publishing?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And it's a question I think about a lot, and I hope so. I mean, that's my short answer. I can't you know, make a definitive statement that yes, you know, these books are challenging. But I'd like to think that when I'm working on them, they certainly do that, the similar thing of like, I kind of disappear into the books for a while. I kind of, you know, they make me want to tear my hair out, that kind of thing. So the short answer is I hope so. And then the longer answer is that's what I try for, at least. That's not maybe at the forefront of my mind when I'm writing a first draft or something. I just sort of let the text kind of tell me what's going on. But when I'm editing, that's absolutely the case. If I write a piece like something short, and if, you know, looking at it for the first time after not having looked at it for a month or a few weeks or something, if I go, you know what, this doesn't really have, it doesn't have depth, or it's not, people aren't going to want to read it twice, or I feel like I can figure it out as a reader right now, I just throw it away, because I mean, I just feel like we're not, there's enough literature that is sort of nice and digestible and pleasing, and it's like a one read type of thing. I don't know if we need any more of that. And I mean, nor, by the way, do we might not need any more literature, period. but I just feel responsible. Like, if I'm going to put something out there, it should be something that somebody feels the desire to sort of live in for a while and be perplexed by and never be able to quite solve.
Your press, you say that you want to promote work sustainably. Now, what does that mean to you as a publisher?
You know, I guess I first kind of wrote that because I've always been, I mean, not always, but maybe since I was 14 or 15 or something, I've always been kind of ecologically minded, and I think a lot about just sort of the cost of producing things, and not, you know, not just financial. I more the more broad sort of ecological cost of producing things and objects. And so I thought from the beginning of the press, I was like, well, I want to make sure that if I'm publishing books, I'm not publishing books in a way that's ecologically irresponsible. Like, if I have the option of publishing a book with paper stock that's 100% post-consumer recycled, I'll do it, because, I mean, it'll cost more, but so what? I mean, I just think we're at a point now that if we're producing objects to be sold and we're not considering their ecological cost, we're being unethical. And so I just knew that if I produce books and didn't focus on that, or at least consider it, and try to work out something that felt right to me, that I just wouldn't feel good about publishing books, period, no matter their content. So I just felt like it had to be a possibility for me to produce books that, like I said, were a little more ecologically considerate or considered.
You're also the designer of all your books, but you also work as a designer for another publishing company as well. Now, how did you get into that? I know you said that you're always an artist, and that's always been a part of what you do. But like, design is a very specific, you know, you're advertising, you're selling this book just based on the cover.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I blame Photoshop. I think that there's a huge generation, or probably now multiple generations, of people who who really just started fucking around with Photoshop, and then that became a fun thing to do. And I was one of those kids, you know, I would like, because I lost my ability to draw and to paint when I was like, I did that when I was a kid, and I wasn't good by any means, but I enjoyed it. But then I stopped doing it as I became a teenager. I don't know why, but what I did do was just fiddle around with Photoshop and make dumb things, you know? And then when I sort of became more and more, interested in literature and the book as an object, and then when I became like full-blown book fetishist, I went, well, sure, I had this weird hubris where I was like, well, I can make a nice book cover. And that was, to be honest, that was one of the reasons why I started the press too, because I thought there were a lot of small and indie presses out there that were putting out books that were interesting, but were not really pleasing objects to look at. I mean, they just had really ugly covers. And I thought, shit, like that's a disservice to the author. That's a disservice to the book. And now I just feel like we have no excuse. Like indie publishers have no excuse not to have a good looking book, because even if there's not somebody on the staff of the publishing company who can design an interesting looking cover, there's oceans upon oceans of freelancers who are
right.
to do that, and, yeah. and they should be able to get paid to do that. But again, I'm you know, a hubristic person, and so I thought, well, I can do that myself. And then I found that that was a really rewarding part of the process, was just working with an author and going to them and saying, I want to give you whatever cover you want. Like, what do you want? And then, of course, not to say that I don't come with ideas or say, like, here's what I'm thinking could work, but I just thought that authors might not get that sentence said to them a lot. And particularly if they, you know, move on to bigger and bigger houses. And so I thought, well, shit, I mean, what is the benefit of publishing with a small publishing company? You get to work with the editor pretty intimately,
mm-hmm.
and ideally you should be able to get the book that you want.
Right.
I mean, with no compromise. And so that was a big part of my sort of editorial aim. And then I thought, well, you know, I'm relatively capable with Photoshop and Illustrator and all those programs and like a camera. So I should be able to give the author the book cover they want.
Well, they look great.
Thank you very much.
I mean, they definitely kind of like the Sator Rotas Square. You have to stare at them and see all the different elements that
Good.
You've put in there.
Good.
One more thing, Ken, you know, with Black Hill Press, we started this project earlier in the year called Routinology, where we study the routines of creative people. You know, what everybody needs to get in their creative, productive mind space.
Mm-hmm.
So would you mind giving us a little bit of what your routine is, what you need? Do you have an addiction to caffeine or methamphetamines that you need to get everything started?
Well, I'm working on a book that I've been working on now for entirely too long, and I should probably just start taking Dexedrine or something, but I won't, because I guess I want a functional life. But yeah, you know, I'm not addicted to caffeine. I'm strangely, I don't really drink caffeine, which I feel like sets me out as a rare bird among writers. And it's, again, that's probably to my detriment. I should probably have a terrible coffee addiction. But you know, to be honest, my routine's always kind of weird. I'm a sporadic person. I will, for 1 to 3 months, really, like I said, when I say disappear, I don't really say that lightly. Like, I don't have much of a social life when I'm working on a Sator book. I don't really leave the house much. My wife like worries about me and like slides food under the door, that type of thing. So I feel like that's the mode I like best, although I've been trying to break that, and I've been working about every day on a book for about the past 6 months, and I just started over a draft, and I have been working on this book for over 4 years, and I just decided, okay, I need to do this in a sort of a serious and steady way, because I've got sort of an ideal sort of territory that the book intends to map, and it's big, and so I realized that I can't like do the same, you know, rabbit hole treatment with this, because I'd be in that hole for a couple of years. And, you know, I'd also need to like make a living and be a person. And so I've just been working every day, and I'm trying writing by hand for the first time to slow myself down, because I've got some goals with the language of the book, and a sort of, not necessarily transparency, but just a simplicity in the language. And I feel like if I'm at the keyboard, I can begin to riff a little bit. And I wanted to deny myself that possibility.
Yeah.
So I take around a little notebook. I got a pen, and I'm also going to school as a sort of strangely at like 25, I decided to be an undergrad. And so now primarily it's just in between classes, or for about an hour a day, I'll just open up the notebook and sit in an empty classroom in school and just sort of work on it, put in little chunks at a time. But I don't really have any rituals, to be honest. Ever since reading this, there's this great Brian Evanson interview in which, you know, he got asked like this kind of the same question, like, you know, what are your routines? Do you need anything to write? Do you need anything to be creative? And he said something that I really crystallized what I've been sort of worried about or thinking about for a long time. He said, you know, I take it when I can get it, and I'm not precious about it at all. If that means I'm writing on my phone, I write on my phone. If that means I'm writing on a post-it note, it's a post-it note. Like I don't care. I don't care about the means. I just, as long as I'm writing, I just write.
Right.
And that really struck me as like a you know, weird teenager who fell in love with Zen Buddhism for, you know, whatever, 6 months, which I feel like is a typical teenage religious experience. and you know, but just that idea of like, when you eat, just eat, when you write, just write, that has really appealed to me, and I try to do that as much as possible. And so when Brian said that, I went, okay, this totally makes sense. So now I'm completely like platform agnostic. Again, I don't have any special implement I need. I just, when I have a little free time and I decide, okay, you know, chip a little thing into the bucket of the novel, I just do that and don't let myself get distracted. And then that's that. And then I hope, you know, in another 4 or 5 years or something, I'll have a draft that's decent.
Ken, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the excellent questions.
Absolutely. It was a lot of fun talking to you.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. And good luck. Hopefully no more gas leaks in Hollywood.
This has been the How the Why by Black Hill Press. I'm your host, John Barrett Ingalls. The show is produced by Kevin Stanek and yours truly, with production assistance by Sarah Becker. The music is Maya Lua by Bossa Zuzu. I wanted to thank everybody for your creativity and your inspiration, and to remind you all to keep making art. Thank you.